everyone. I'm Stu, your co-host, and I'm here with the paranormalist, Patty Wilson. Patty, how are you this very bright and cheery spring day?
I am doing just fine. I was right in our world as at this moment in time, and that's all any of us can really ask.
Very nice.
And we took a little bit of a hiatus because of the holiday and everything. So I'm really excited to be back and welcome everybody back. Thank you for being patient, and we're excited you're with us again.
Yeah, it's like 2 weeks. I had to make sure that I click the record button and just, you know, all the different things that I used to do on a weekly basis, I had to think about again. So I would like to say, if you are joining us for the first time, we thank you for finding our podcast and hope you will enjoy it. Please click the like button. Consider subscribing if you haven't already. For those who are returning, we thank you for coming back. And we hope you're really going to enjoy the rest of the episodes that are coming this year. Because I don't plan on doing anything else. How about you?
Nope. Nothing.
All right. So with that, I think, we don't really have to pay the bills because we do it out of we don't have any ads or anything like that. But what is our topic for today?
So I was looking at some UFO incidents that involved the police departments. And, why is it that more police officers aren't talking and telling their stories? There's a lot of stories I know of police officers who have seen things and they privately tell investigators or what have you, but they don't always come out. And I started looking at it, and I can see, well, why, obviously, because they get harassed and what have you. But some of the most amazing stories have come forward from police officers, and we rarely talk about them. They just kind of get lost in the shuffle. And so I wanted to share some of them today. One of my favorite is the story of Police Sergeant Lonnie Zamora, who in 1964 was driving through the area where he was patrolling. In he looked down, it was in New Mexico, and he looked down into an area, which is a kind of like a little canyon, and he saw something down there, glinting light. And his first thought was that a car accident had happened, and a car had shot off the highway down through there. So he reaches out really quick, and he gets hold of the dispatcher, a gentleman by the name of Nep Lopez. And he says, hey, I think there's a possible motor vehicle accident down here in the area. He gives him kind of coordinates to it. It's like 5:45 in the evening on April 24th. So it's daylight, pure daylight still. And he says, I think I better check it out. So he starts, gets out of his car, and he's looking when he sees an object. And the object he describes as, it looks like a balloon. And he says, can you get me the state police? And they reach out to Police Sergeant Chavez, who is to meet him at the location. When Chavez arrives, he says, what's going on, dude? And he says, look at this down here. There's this burning brush down here. There's these tripod marks. And they walk down, and sure enough, there's this smoldering grass, this burning brush. You can see what looks like a three-pronged outline, as though something heavy has sat in the sand. And Zamora tells them that what had happened was he had been pursuing a car down the road outside of Socorro, and had heard a roar and saw a flame in the sky to the southwest in the distance. He thought maybe a half mile, maybe a little more. And thinking that it was a dynamite shack that he knew was out there, he thought maybe it had blown up. So he discontinued his chase and had turned to go in the direction of the dynamite shack when he observes a shiny object down in the area and decides that must be a car, maybe a white car, because it was silver white is how he described it. And he said it was standing on its hood or trunk, was upright. So it was perpendicular. And it looked like it was aluminum. It was whitish and not chrome. He made a point of that. And he said it was shaped like the letter zero or O. rather, and he claimed that he saw two people outside of the vehicle in white overalls. He described them as normal people, either small adults or large kids, teenage size, 14, 15. And he said, I could hear a roar. I saw blue and orange flames from underneath the object, which then rose quickly as I got out of the car and moved away. So the state police officer helps him secure the scene. They call for, you know, for photographs and all of this stuff. And he documents everything to the best of their ability. And then they go back. They file the report. And the next day, life for Lonnie Zamora is never the same. He gets to work. People start making fun of him, you know, small space people. What were you drinking? What did you have in your coffee? You know, now maybe he's a space cadet, you know, that kind of thing. A lot of razzing. And things got worse because within a few days, the story reaches the investigators from Project Blue Book. For those who don't know, that was a federal government project. And they were looking into cases ostensibly to determine if they were explainable, unexplained, or could be something that they didn't have any kind of a definition for. The truth is Project Blue Book appears to have been put together to debunk and to humiliate people who possibly reported UFO encounters. Zamora does not fare any better than the rest. So they immediately start looking for plausible causes. And I want to say this. I'm not saying you shouldn't. If I were doing a paranormal investigation, I would look for my plausible causes first. But some of their plausible causes become really crazy and out there. And they make him sound insane. So the first one is a skeptic by the name of Stuart Campbell, who works for Project Blue Book. And he says Zamora observed, almost certainly, that's his exact words, a mirage of the star Canopus. And he suggested that that was what had happened. And then when that fell apart, he came out with another one. He said, oh, it was lunar landing devices being tested by the personnel from White Sands missile range. And when White Sands came back and said, we didn't test anything in that area at that time. Now, this is a federal agency reporting to a federal agency, and they did let it be known publicly that they were not the ones who were the culprits. Then third explanation was, oh, it was students from New Mexico Tech, which was a few miles down the road. They set this up to freak out the police. Then when the president of New Mexico Tech supported the idea that the students from the school were responsible and said that the object observed by Zamora was a candle inside of a balloon and not sophisticated, the case becomes called a hoax. Interestingly enough, that exact same explanation would be used on two different cases in central Pennsylvania, which is the area that Sue and I live in. In the 1960s and 70s, people saying that it was a balloon or a dry cleaning bag that had a candle inside of it that was supported with a wooden frame, and the heat from the candle caused it to rise, and that this was what was causing these events. So it's an interesting all-purpose solution. If you can't go any other direction, how do you refute that? But it also doesn't explain the burned brush, the blue and orange flames, he reports, the smoldering marks all around, the circular pattern that's on the ground, the three tripod leg marks that they took photographs of. So then another skeptic who works for Blue Book comes forward and says, his name's Philip Kloss, and he said unequivocally, this is a quote, unequivocally, I characterize the case as a hoax perpetrated in the attempt to increase tourism in Zamora. Oh. So you can imagine, what Lonnie Zamora's life was like. He was hounded out of the police department. In 1966, the local Chamber of Commerce did make a walking path down to the area. They didn't make any money or anything like that, but they did make a walking path down to the general area where Zamora claimed he had the sightings. And a little walkway was put in there where you could kind of walk. Now, and there were wooden benches to sit on, but it was at least a half a mile from the actual location. It was just kind of in the general area. You could kind of overlook it. You know what I mean? And it's now there are people who go there, but not many. So eventually, Zamora quit his job and as a police officer. He refused to talk to the UFO enthusiasts. He refused to talk to the Air Force and Project Blue Book. He literally just shut his whole life down. Interestingly enough, Zamora and the other police officer on the scene would say they had taken photographs at the time using the then popular Polaroid cameras, the ones that shot the picture out and you had to wait for it.
Right.
And they both testified later that the Project Blue Book and the Air Force confiscated all the photographs, and then Project Blue Book and the Air Force both stated they had never seen any photos. There were none in the file. So, you know, it did not bode well for poor Lonnie Zamora. And it's a fascinating case. There's a lot more to it than they want to admit. I've seen interviews with this gentleman, and, you know, he talks about what he saw with great certitude. It was in the middle of the afternoon. There's another police officer who responds. The guy who catches the call and says to him, stay on the scene, see if you can get some photographs, you know, the guys running the radio that day. They all three would continue to tell the same story, that, you know, what they saw or what Zamora reported back, which is recorded. And they were treated as though they were all three, they were told they were conspiring to help the Chamber of Commerce to build tourism. And I have to tell you, if I were going to build tourism, that wouldn't be the way to do it. In the 1960s, there was very little UFO tourism going on. You might have a handful of investigators wandering off somewhere and a couple wackos that are just, you know, ready to go to Mars or whatever, but overall, most people weren't doing that in the 1960s. They just weren't. So when you're looking at cases, and I, one of the things that I like to make to say about some of these older cases is that there wasn't a lot of publicity at the time. So the stuff they're reporting is fairly unknown to the general public. Like today, because of Facebook and you know, the internet and what have you, you can look up everything under the sun and get information right away. Like, you know, crop circle happens in England or France within 20 minutes of somebody posting it. You can know all of the details. It wasn't that way back then. Back then, it was really controlled by three national press agencies, which were, you know, the CBS, ABC, and NBC, The Wire, which was AP. There were just a few agencies out there, and they weren't printing much.
Yeah. I always remembered hearing that from AP and UPI.
So there weren't, I mean, it wasn't like today where everybody and their uncle can do this. So it comes, it goes really fast. People had a little chuckle, except for, of course, those people whose lives are altered by it.
That makes me angry than anything else, that our government, in an effort to maintain secrecy, would essentially destroy one of its citizens. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be the United States, not Russia. Yeah, that's...
I won't lie to you, there's more transparency in Russia. Like, their cases, there is, honestly, about UFOs.
We've had them before, but I mean, as far as the secrecy of things, not just UFO stuff. It's just, you know, looking all the way back. I mean, whenever you and I were in school, you know, we all heard about Pravda, and how that was, you know, the truth, you know, and how a state-run newspaper. Well, I think governments are fundamentally evil, but I won't get on a soapbox about that right now.
No,
I want to hear your stories.
So the next story I wanted to tell is one I've actually written about in my book on UFOs, and I wrote about it in another book as well. And I find this to be one of the most fascinating stories out there. And I don't care what story you're looking at today, this is still one of the most amazing paranormal stories when it comes to UFO that I have ever heard. So this took place in about 1966, 67. I think it was April 17th of 1966 in a small town in Ohio. Okay. There's a guy by the name of Dale Spahr, who's the sheriff of Portage County. He's a big guy, about 6'7". I apologize for the neighbor dog barking. And he's a big guy back in that time frame. Had a great sense of humor. He had been a gunner on a B-51 in Korea. He was known in the police force for having a little bit of a lead foot, and got reprimanded for driving a little fast a few times in the little town of Ravenna where he lived. He had a partner whose name was Wilbur Neff. Everybody called him Barney because he was kind of thin like Barney from the Andy Griffith show. But he was a good officer, good family. Had a wife and two little boys. And on the morning of April the 17th, 1966, their lives get derailed. So Spahr and Neff are out on an abandoned vehicle call on the side of State Route 224 near the town of Atwater. It's 5 o'clock in the morning. It's an isolated area, lots of trees, and they're out there to make sure that, like, nobody's died in a car. There's no hanky-panky going on out there. You know, drugs or something like that. It's the 60s. So they get to that area, and as they pull in to this wide spot where this vehicle's at, they notice a glowing light rising up out of the woods. At treetop level, this light begins to move toward them. This is their testimony. It's shaped kind of like an ice cream cone on its side, with the ice cream, the wider part, coming first and the tail at the end. Okay. And he said it, they both described it as making a sound like an overloaded transformer. So that kind of buzzy sound. And is when it got close, they could actually feel heat radiating off of it. Like it was really, really pushing out the heat. And then slowly it starts down Route 224. They return to the cruiser, they radio dispatch, they tell them what they're seeing, and the dispatch sergeant says, follow it. They get in the car and they start. This will turn out to be the longest known police chase of a UFO in American history, maybe world history. I mean, I know for sure the American history. So Spahr's driving, he's the dude with the lead foot, and the faster he accelerates to get up under it so he can see better, the faster it accelerates to make sure he can't. Soon they're going down Route 14. As it's moving and turning, he's moving and finding roads to keep it in, you know, up in sight. And he's watching the odometer hit 100 miles per hour. He had to be in one of those great big monster old police cruisers, you know, the ones with eight cylinders that really move. And occasionally they'd stop for a light or traffic or something, and the craft slowed down to wait for him. Both police officers said it was like playing cat and mouse, and they would that's exactly how they felt. Like this thing wanted them to see it, but he didn't know why. Now, as they're moving on, they get word that there's a cop from East Palestine, Ohio, who's in his own private car. His name is Wayne Houston. And he sees them going by in a chase, and he gets on the radio on a CB, and he gets into the station, and he says, tell them I'm behind him in a civilian car. I'm a police officer, and I'm here to assist. So he's tagging along. So now we got two sets of cops going out there chasing this UFO. He witnesses the whole same thing, right? Then it hits the Pennsylvania line. When they realize they're going to come up to the Pennsylvania line, they start pay, you know, radioing in, dude, we can't cross the Pennsylvania line. We can't cross. We need permission. We need permission. We need permission. And immediately, within 5 minutes, they get permission. Not only do they get permission, but Frank Penzanella is a Pennsylvania state cop who's listening to this on the radio and yells, I'm 5 minutes out. I'll join the chase, boys.
Okay.
And he hops in behind them. So now we have no less than four cops, three from Ohio, one from PA, all witnessing this thing. And they're watching it. They're getting, they didn't have cameras in the cars at the time. They're watching it. They're reporting back as they're driving. Because, you know, Spar has Neff in the car with him. So Neff's on the radio going, this is what's going on. This is what's going on. This is what's going on. And Spar is doing his Mario Andretti impersonation, keeping that thing in sight. And the other boys are doing their best to keep up behind him. This is insane. All total, Spar chases that UFO 86 miles across two states into Pennsylvania. And they pull up to where the car, the stupid UFO starts to stop, and it hovers. They jump out, all four officers, look at each other for a second, and rush toward the UFO. What the hell I think they were thought they were going to do, I do not know. But they're standing under it, and they say the heat is so intense it forces them backward. And then it darts straight up in the sky and disappears.
Wow.
Think about it. Now, not only do these four officers see it, but Spar and Neff's captain happens to be at home listening on his radio when they're coming through the little town he lives in. He goes outside and stands in his own front yard and watches the ice cream cone UFO and his guys go by. Now we got five cops who see this thing. The next day, the headlines in the local papers are, they tailed a saucer 86 miles. They go home thinking it's all over. That's the end of it. It gets picked up by the AP when the wire services. There are stations calling from the all around the world, Japanese stations, stations from the Middle East, from Europe. They want to hear this crazy story about five cops, you know, four chasing it across two states in the United States. It's insane. By the next morning, Spar and Neff turn up for work and they are ridiculed horrendously by the other cops. You know, again, it's the, are you a space cadet? You know, what you boys been drinking? Blah, blah, blah. Harass and what have you. Now, Neff took it in stride pretty much, but Spar lost about 20 pounds over the thing. And then it gets worse. Project Blue Book shows up. And they have the four officers. They talk to them, and they come up with one of their amazing, absolutely amazing answers. They were chasing the planet Venus that was being refracted through the fog.
Seems reasonable, right? Right.
Yep. Now, Spar has a lot of problems with this. Like, he feels like his whole life has been invalidated. And he ends up losing everything. Within 6 months, he's lost his job. He's lost his wife and his children. A reporter from the Plain Dealer found him living in a motel and said that he was living, subsisting on peanut butter and jelly and only finding enough work to pay rent at this sleazy motel. Now, his quote to this reporter is, I'm 34 years old, and what do I have? Nothing. Who knows me? To everyone, I'm Dale Spar, the nut who chased a flying saucer. That's all I am today. His whole life is shot. He will go through his whole life bearing this burden. He doesn't actually get to meet his kids until years later. Again, he meets them, and it's actually because somebody tries to interview him on a TV show, and it's so odd that his two sons turned out to watch this show, and when they're watching it, their mother goes by, looks, and she says, oh my gosh, that's your dad. And the older boy says, I thought that was him. Now, they were pretty small whenever this all happened. So he calls the TV station and says, can you tell this guy that he's my dad and I live at this address and I'd really like to see him? So 2 weeks later, Spar gets out of of his vehicle. The boy, as an adult, is interviewed and he says he just seemed to keep unfolding out of that truck, all 6'7" of him. And I stood in the on the porch and I watched him and I said, are you my dad? And he said, yes, son, I am. My brother came outside and he said, are you my dad? And he laughed and he said, yes, son, I am. And he said he came in and out of our lives after that, but he didn't stay all the time. So basically, Spar goes to West Virginia, becomes a the reporters hunt him down there where he's working as a coal miner. He gets injured at the coal mines and he ends up in the hospital. He's in a coma in the hospital for days. His eyes are wide open, but he is completely in a coma. Later on, when wants to know what happened during the time he was in a coma. You know, were people there to see him? Did anybody call? What was going on? And the one nurse said, well, we had a nurse who wouldn't sit with you. We were supposed to have a nurse that sat with you all the time in case you showed any signs of distress or you started to come out of the coma. And she said, but the last couple hours, but she only lasted a couple hours, the nurse we hired. I guess she came out running from the room screaming, I can't sit with this man. He's possessed by an alien. I don't know what that means. There's nothing more about it except for that was the quote.
Definitely trying to wrap my head around that one, but
Yeah,
you'd
I
think
mean,
that.
like I read that a couple times, and I honestly don't know what that meant. Was he saying something? Did he look different? I have no idea. But that is exactly what Spar was told. He would subsequently tell it to his sons, who would later tell it to the reporter who does this article, one of the articles I read. So he said that whenever he got better, he moved back to Ohio. He remarried, and he didn't really talk much except for when he was in the bar. He opened a bar of his own, and once in a while, on a slow night, he would talk about Floyd, is what he called the UFO. And if the guys were in a good mood, he'd say, "Okay, fellas, just sit here. I'll tell you a little story about Floyd." And he would tell about the chase. Later, interesting enough, I had no idea. He would be contacted by Steven Spielberg for the Close Encounters of the Third Kind. He wanted him to be kind of a consultant because of what had happened. There's a scene at the beginning of the movie where
Yep.
the guy's chasing. Okay, that's supposed to be him. It made him mad that he wasn't the main character, that his character wasn't the main character, and he quit the job.
Yeah, that's the one with the mailboxes going back and forth, and yep.
Yep. And then in 1983, he passed away. And to this day, nobody has ever really been able to, other than the story I just told you about the planet Venus, nobody's ever been able to offer any other explanation than, other than five police officers saw a UFO, sort of comet shaped, is really, and he called it ice cream cone shaped, but big on the one end and very narrow, like with the tail on the other. Four of whom chased it across country, literally. Three from Ohio all the way into Pennsylvania, where the fourth one picked up the chase, and they pulled up in the middle of a town near a library where the thing paused and was hovering upward and left.
Well, the Venus story doesn't hold water because, so let's say you're moving, right? And hell, if you've ever been riding in a car and you see, a bright star or something like that, and as you're driving, it seems like you never, well, obviously you're not getting any closer because it's light years away. But
Right.
even if something's much closer, and if you're following it, all right, so let's just say for sake of argument that it was the planet Venus. What about the cop who was in his house and watch the thing go by, right? I'm sorry, planet Venus isn't zipping by fast enough that you would see it moving and cars moving too at the same time. So yeah, that story doesn't hold, or that explanation doesn't hold water at all.
No, it's a fascinating story, and there's never been any other clear explanation. The men who were involved never recanted, never said, "Oh, screw it, I didn't see anything. It was a joke." Nothing. They all went to their grave supporting each other that they saw what they saw on that day and followed it where they followed it, and it did exactly what I described. And that's a bona fides you could take to court for anything else.
True. And I mean, even if that happened today and you have umpteen dozen people with cell phones and recording it, so let's say you have all these different videos, the same debunky kind of people are going to come out and say, well, that's just all, you fake the video trying to get publicity. It's, although I think the populace is a little more sympathetic to things now, anything paranormal now, supernatural, alien, whatever, versus, hard to think about it. 60 years ago in the 60s.
So my next story I wanted to tell comes from 1966, and it came through the research files of a researcher by the name of Albert Rosales, and his original source was John Keel, as in Mothman. And this took place in Gaffney, South Carolina. It's about 4 o'clock in the morning. There's two police officers. Their names are Hutchins and Husky.
Sounds like a
And
TV show.
that's what I thought too, but that's their names, Hutchins and Husky. They're driving down a rural area outside of Gaffney, known as West Buford Street Extension. There's a right angle bend in the road, and out of the darkness, their headlights catch a metal object directly in front of them. It was spherical, flat and wide, no visible light or portholes to be seen. The car does not stall. It stops as the object settles down within a few feet of the ground. It's hovering literally about 4 feet off the ground. Both men get out of the car. They're absolutely shocked. And their best guesstimate would be 20 feet in diameter. Suddenly, a small door opens at the underside of the vehicle, of this circular vehicle. And they said the sphere made no noise, and a short ladder dropped out, probably about 5 to 6 feet long. And a figure appeared in the doorway, came down the ladder, and walked toward the police officers. The figure pointed, stopped at about 15 to 20 feet from them. And they said he didn't move stiffly. This is Officer Hutchins' testimony. He moved like anybody else, but kind of slow, like he was taking his time. He wasn't scared of us or anything like that. He appeared to be a human, was about the size of a 12-year-old boy, maybe 4 foot tall. He wore no helmet, no headgear, was dressed in a gold suit, no buttons or zippers. His costume was shiny and metallic. It reflected in the headlights. It was not self-illuminating. And the humanoid is what he calls it from this point forward. He says it would ask questions and ignore us when we tried to ask questions in return. Hutchins said he could not remember seeing the feet of the creature. It was standing in high grass, and so the feet were hidden. So he doesn't really know what the feet looked like. They didn't remember the full context of the conversation, but he said the being spoke English, perfect English, didn't have any kind of accent. He acted like he knew what he was saying and doing, did not make any quick moves or false moves. He just stood and talked to the witnesses. He wanted to know why we were dressed alike. His speech was very precise. He pronounced each word very carefully. When asked where he was from, he laughed. The meeting was maybe 2 to 3 minutes long. And then the being said to him, I said it very slow, I will return in 2 days. It turned and walked back to the ladder and climbed back inside the object. The door closed and the craft made a slight whirring sound, like an engine muffler with a muffler on it, and then it rose and vanished. Now, if that was the end of the story, that would be amazing, but it's not. There are other cases where something very similar happened. These two officers would not agree to any like regression therapy or anything like that. They were afraid to find out what happened. There's more to this. So in Rosales, the next year in Ashland, from Rosales, we're going to Ashland, Nebraska, where a state trooper by the name of Herbert Schreimer, he's 22 years old, was out on patrol on a cold December night looking into a disturbance of local livestock. There were rumors that there was a predator in the area prowling around, and the livestock had been disappearing and had been spooked through the last few nights. So now he's being told, go out and check around the livestock in these various fields, see what's going on. He came to what he thought was a truck parked right in the middle of the road ahead. But when he stopped his car, got out of it, at first thinking that it was going to be, somebody needing assistance. And as he gets a little closer with his flashlight, he sees what he describes as a football-shaped glowing craft of some sort with a red lighted portholes around the circumference. It hovered above the ground before shooting off into the night with a fiery flash of light. That was the end of it, according to the original report. But eventually, because he kept having nightmares and struggling, he went to a doctor who put him under hypnosis, and this is his story. He says the object did not move away too far. It went to the nearby field and sat down on three legs. Remember, Lonnie Zamora had three legs for his craft. While his radio and lights and engine suddenly failed behind him, he knew he couldn't get away. These beings approached his car. They prevented him from fleeing or drawing his revolver using a mental block of some sort. And one sprayed the car with greenish gas, while a second being shone a bright light on him. He felt paralyzed and passed out. He said these humanoids had long heads. They were thin, flat nose, slit mouths, slanted eyes, 5 feet tall, gray white skin, wore uniforms, boots and gloves and helmets, silver gray. They had a small antenna and an emblem of a serpent on the left breast of their uniform. He said when he came to, he got out of the car, and one being that had been the leader asked him if he was the watchman, and he said no, and the being said, would you like to see what's in our craft? And he said, I didn't want to go, but I was afraid to say no. So he nodded, and they took him into the craft where he saw equipment. And he said the room was maybe 20 by 26 feet, 6 foot tall, cold and lighted by strips of light inside the ceiling. Recessed lighting is what it sounds like of some sort. There were chairs, panels, viewing screens. There was a crystalline rotor linked to two columns, and the leader demonstrated a device like a tape player, which seemed to transfer data to the witness's brain while they conversed. So he's like literally hits a button, instead of watching it on a screen, you watch it in your head. He said the being used broken English, and it came from deep inside his body, not his throat or his mouth. It just seemed like it was bellowing out from inside of his body. And he said he understood the tapes, but only telepathically. And he said they told him that he came from another galaxy, that there were other bases on other planets, that they were there beneath the sea of our country, of our world, and in the polar regions. They used an electromagnetic propulsion system and water to operate ships, and that they were here because they were afraid that the humans would destroy the Earth, and because they were to prepare humans for eventual contact. He said he saw images of being standing guard outside of the ship. And then he saw it flying again across the sky in these telepathic images. And then when this was all done, the being said, "You must forget what you have seen." And I don't understand why they would show it to him if they felt he needed to forget it, but they did. And he said he was returned to the police car and the ship left. Later that night, he woke up driving, did not remember any of this until the hypnosis session. All we remembered was after the thing took up in the air, he was on the other side of it driving and going down the road. He felt sick. He was weak and nervous. He had a red welt on his neck and a chronic buzzing in his ears. He had trouble sleeping later, and he left being a police officer. During the investigation, he said there were things that happened to him that he would not tell, and he refused. And he left being a police officer. He refused to ever speak about this again.
Well, I guess from my feeble human mind, I couldn't also fathom why they would say, "You want to come look and, you know, do all this," and then say, but now you got to forget it all. You know,
yeah.
That just, I just can't see the big picture, I guess.
It's a really typical statement, you know, about we're preparing you for eventual contact, and we're preparing you because we're afraid the world, you're going to destroy the world, blah, blah, blah. And we're sharing this world with you now too. And, you know, that kind of stuff. So the message isn't, I mean, in the 1960s, yes, it was kind of new, but it's not a far-fetched message, and it was given to many other people through at least another 30-year span. So I don't know why he had to forget it, but that's his story. He stuck to it, even through hypnosis, and then he just literally dropped off the planet, did not want anybody to talk to him about it, and said, I just wanted to go away.
You'd think if their purpose was to stop humanity from destroying the planet, you wouldn't start with a town cop someplace. You would start with the people who have the football, the people who have the button. Maybe they did. And they forgot.
Yeah. Maybe they could. Yeah. Maybe those people weren't paying attention, or maybe they'd already cut those deals that they say that Eisenhower cut, you know? And maybe there's more than one group of them, and some had one set of agendas and another had another set of agendas. Maybe the reason they felt they needed to let us know they existed is because the ones with a more negative set of agendas had already made their deals. And they saw that in the future they might have to, you know, step out of the shadows for some reason. I don't know, but it's a fascinating story. So we're going to move up to 1976. There's a police officer by the name of Frank Agarigola. And Frank was driving along with a newspaper reporter who was doing a kind of a drive-through with him. You know how sometimes reporters will get in a car and just kind of report on what the whole shift is like? This guy, Sonny Schwartz, was doing that. So they were in Ventnor or Atlantic North, New Jersey. They were just kind of driving along. Cop was doing his job. The reporter's there to watch and, you know, talk about it in an article in the next few days. When they see this bright white object with a bright haze around it out over the boardwalk along the sea, the object seems to be following them. So they're watching it and they wonder what they're supposed to do. And as they're observing near the object coming across the boardwalk, there's a very tall man with a huge chested shoulders, you know, walking along. He's lurching, that's their word, lurching down the boardwalk in front of their car. The machine's right here, and he comes lurching out in front of them. He wore a 3/4 length suede coat and a 10-gallon Stetson hat. Not normal, typical clothing for New Jersey. And when they got back to the station, they found out that several other police officers had called the area into the area because they also had witnessed the object and a strange, large intruder. And none of them could go any further than that. They saw it, then they black out, and when they come to, they're sitting in their car, everything's good, and someplace else the report comes in. But we're looking at a minimum of four different police officers. And in this instance, the police officer had with him the reporter, who also said he saw it. He didn't argue. He said, that's what I saw. That's a story, isn't it?
And a half.
Yeah, I just thought it was a fascinating story. So we're going to go to Pennsylvania, 2017.
Oh,
there's a police officer who's driving along Westmoreland County, PA. It's kind of a wooded area. He's on his way through, you know, just checking the area out. It's kind of remote. He notices a silvery sheen of light ahead on low to the ground. As he gets close, he realizes that the light is emanating from a ball of light about 7 foot up in on what looks to be the head of a Bigfoot-like creature. So just the ball of light on the head of a big, hairy Bigfoot. And it's actually glowing outward, so it's self-illuminating. But no head, just the ball of light. Now, this story was originally caught by Stan Gordon, and this is the report. So this thing, like I said, is 6 to 7 feet tall. It is almost skeletal thin. That, which is very different. You never hear Bigfoot's, you know, being that thin. Right. Whatever this thing was, it was that thin. When the first officer first observed it, it was laying on its belly on the ground with its head facing towards the road. It then stood up when he slowed down, and it was dark in a location, so he could see the dull glow of the glowing head illuminating the upper section of the body. While the officer watched, the creature went to the right, and the head lit the shoulder area. So he could see the upper torso of the thing because of the light, could see nothing of the lower torso. It moved, it realized it had been seen, and then it took off at what they describe as an incredible speed, away from the road back into the woods. It moved so fast that you could barely see it. It was here, it was gone. But whatever it did, it ran with locomotion, so that your arms were moving. You could definitely tell it was moving like a bipedal creature. The police officer would be quoted as saying, it was faster than anything I have ever seen. It was there, then it was gone. It was on two legs, I think. I couldn't see the lower half of the body. He described the head as only 8 to 10 inches in diameter, which is a really little head for something that big. It was, the chest was only 18 inches. Like I said, it was emaciated, whatever it was. It was very, very thin, real thin. The body was grayish blue, where he could see it. No facial features. The officer watched it for at least 10 seconds. And if that sounds like a very little period of time, time 10 seconds and see what you can notice. He pulled up his vehicle to the location where the creature had been, turned his vehicle spotlight on and looked around the area, but nothing. The officer did not get out of his car. I do not blame him. And he tried to make sense out of what was there. He did report the incident in detail. However, nobody has any clue what this was. Fascinating story. Never heard one quite like it.
Yeah, the description of the person, being, whatever.
Yeah, it's not like anything I've ever heard in my whole life. I have one last story I want to share. There are literally probably 200 of them that I've collected over time. And this next last one I wanted to tell was fascinating because it came from England. And this is actually a story that is still a mystery to this day. This story's well over 40 years old now. But it's a fascinating story, and it's got some really weird components to it. So I wanted to share it because I just thought it was really interesting. There were two police officers who witnessed this. So one of them was a young police officer who found himself about 100 yards down a county lane. He's in his patrol car when a mysterious object vanished in his rearview mirror. So he sees this object coming up bright light. He's can't explain it. His name is Alan Godfrey. Now, this is going to sound crazy to people today, but they didn't have any way to record this. So the police often would use a pen and paper to sketch like an accident scene or a perpetrator as best they could, writing down everything they could remember so they didn't lose any of it, and then go back later because, you know, in the early 1960s, people didn't always have a camera, or a camera wasn't actually able to take a photograph. Like in the darkness like that, you'd have just gotten a dark picture. And you couldn't have moved like, you know, like we can with a camera today, that kind of thing. So the best he had was pen and paper. He sketched it. So Godfrey sketches it. He doesn't really know what to do with this. So we're going to go on to the story makes headlines. So he tells, you know, he tells the police at his barracks. He says, this is what I saw. He does his police report. He does his due diligence, what we would expect him to do if he saw something unusual. Don't know what it was, sir, but I want you to know it was there. I couldn't find anything prior to, couldn't find anything after the fact, but I definitely saw this large, brightly lit object following me, and then it just winked out. Now, the local newspapers pick up the story, and this is what they find out. They find out that, I'll explain it. I'm going to try to explain it right to you so I don't make it even worse. He drew, there's actually a sketch of it here. He drew a diamond-shaped craft with, you know how the facets of a diamond are cut into it?
Right.
Those are there, just like they would be on a real diamond. And the bottom of it was going counterclockwise very fast, just above the road, picking up debris, you know, sticks, leaves, dirt, and spinning it like a mad little whirlpool. That is the last thing he saw before it blinked out and was gone. So he takes all this back to the, like I said, like to the police department, and he's like, I don't know what to tell you. He goes into town and he tells them, he says, I don't know what to tell you about this. This is what I saw. So he's ordered to go back out the next day, and he's supposed to be looking for, again, cattle. Cattle are, herds of cattle are on the loose. That was the headline in the newspaper. Herds of cattle are on the loose in a little English town. That these cattle were spooked and that they were, you know, running loose and blah, 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 you know. And so he's told he needs to keep an eye out. This all happened at 5 o'clock in the morning where he sees this craft. So he goes out. He's been out all night. It's pouring rain. And he's got this bizarre story about herds of cattle on the loose. So he's driving around just kind of look. And that's when he's going down this lane and he sees this thing, right? As this whole thing's happening, he notices the bus. There's a shuttle bus that goes by. And it's like the morning worker. So it's like the 5 a.m. worker, the people that have to be clocked in at like 6 or, you know, something like that. So they're all on this bus headed in that direction. And he thinks, oh, crap, I got to look for the bloody cows. So he keeps going. He turns down this stupid lane. He has like one more pass and then he can go clock out himself. And that's when this whole thing happens. So he tells the story. The ufologists all come pouring out of nowhere. And they start with their silly ideas. So it was, he chased the moon, you know, it was the bus going by that caused the reflection of the light on the back of the car. The typical, you know, really ridiculous stuff. Of course, he didn't have a cell phone back then, so there's not a whole lot he could do about it. This is where it gets really interesting. He tells this story to a reporter who looks into who he is. He's been trained. He has 5 years on the force. He's actually researched and tried to solve a couple homicides. She starts looking into, and that's what gets really weird. So she starts saying, tell me where this was at. Tell me what you saw. Tell me this. Tell me that. It turns out that right after this, there's a homicide in the area that he ends up investigating. And it's a man who's fallen on from a height onto a pile of bricks, but it doesn't make sense. There's no way for him to have gotten up high to fall on said pile of bricks.
Okay.
Okay.
There's no tower nearby.
Yeah. There's no tower, no tree, no anything like that. you know, he starts taking the obligatory, you know, your Captain Kirk and all the comments coming in and what have you. He catches this police case and he's trying to just focus on, you know, what he should do. This lady reporter says this guy had died, this fellow who fell down on the pile of bricks and stone, that he had died approximately 12 hours after the lights had been seen by Godfrey. And she speculates that maybe the two things are somehow related, as there's no reasonable, rational way for him to have fallen from a height at that spot. Maybe he was in the UFO. So the guy's name is Mr. Adamski. He was 56 years old. He was a miner. He was found there. And he starts to insinuate that he might be a murder victim of this UFO. That is where they leave it. It is a mystery to this day. Now, the officer Godfrey does do the hypnosis. He finally agrees to getting hypnosis, wondering if this might help explain in some way what he might have missed seeing when he does it. So I thought that was like probably the most important part of this, was the fact that he did the hypnosis and then what happened. So they regress him back and he talks about seeing a white light bursting off the mountain, and he started to, it was so bright, and it wasn't behind him, it was in front of him. It was so bright it blinded him. And this is his quote from the testimony. I shouted, "Jesus, the light, I've been blinded." The professors who were in the field, who hypnotized him. They hypnotized him twice. They recorded both sessions to prove that they didn't do leading questions or anything like that. They said, you know, tell me what happened beyond the light. Describe what happened beyond the light. This is what he says. He says, there were childlike creatures who got out of the craft. And then I was carried inside where I met a strange biblical man.
Wow.
He told, he said he was either carried or floated into the craft. The child-sized beings had large heads and they worked alongside the bearded man. That's the biblical man. During the regression, he said, I need to stop now. I can't tell you more about him. He wouldn't like it. And because he started to panic so badly, on both occasions, they had to shut the session down at that point. He said he had no idea what he was saying. He had no idea about the memories until the regression had happened. And he couldn't go any further. He refused to go any further with it at that point because something about the biblical man scared him so badly. So this was researched by Jenny Randles. And for those who don't know, in the 70s and 80s, Jenny Randles was a scientist. And she was also one of the preeminent paranormal psychologists in the entire country. She looked into UFO sightings all around the world. She was never able to figure this particular sighting out. And she worked on the Condon Report. She was, she gathered information from the Freedom of Information Act all around the world and, you know, different countries that have it. She could explain a lot of things or at least make a good stab at them, but she could not explain what happened to Godfrey. And so what did Godfrey see? Who was the religious man? Why did he think he worked with these small alien beings? And what happened to the miner? And how does this all interrelate? And what caused him, Godfrey, to be so terrified of this religious being? Now, there is a theory that aliens are not aliens. They are actually demons. If that is so, was this a powerful demonic entity that he recognized as something religious and spiritual, and he backed off of it? I mean, because if you saw Christ, you wouldn't be scared. You might be in awe, but he wouldn't bring terror to you so bad that they have to bring you out of a hypnotic session. If you saw an angel, and I've talked to people who've seen, I've seen angels, you know, you're emotional, but you're not terrified.
Right.
It's a different set of emotions that go on. What was it about this thing? Why was this particular man so terrifying?
We'll never know.
Probably not. It's a fascinating mystery. There are so many bits and pieces, but none of them fit together. And interestingly enough, this gentleman too quit being a police officer and left the area because he just didn't want to have to deal with the fallout from all of this. And I have to tell you, some of the theories on this one were he had an out-of-body experience. He, I'm trying to think what the other ones were, was chasing the moon. He, even though they did a drug test on him, that he took drugs. And there was a guy who came along, was a scientist, and he created something called the electromagnetic helmet. And it's called I've heard it referred to before as the God machine. They put it on like 900 different people and tested it in the 1990s. And these figures either responded by saying they met or encountered religious people, such as, God or the Prophet Muhammad or Jesus or the Virgin Mary. Or if they didn't have a religious background, they talked about being abducted by aliens. And they know that it messes with the electrical magnetic imagery in your in your brain. So your brain, everything in our body's electromagnetic. So it messes with your brain and causes you to either one of two things. You're either stepping into another dimension and seeing this, or you're hallucinating it, and what your preferences are determine the hallucination. So did this craft create the delusion, or was there something about this being that did cause him to be terrified? It's a fascinating story.
When you said you were going to go to the UK, I thought you were going to do the incident at RAF Woodbridge.
Oh, okay. I thought about that, Randallstown and all that stuff, but I really thought this was a fascinating story because there's so many open questions to this day. And I mean, how do you explain any of this?
Can't.
No. It only gets more interesting. There's hundreds of these cases, and can they all be wrong? One of the things that I know that I've talked to a lot of UFO researchers, and they're saying, look, I will give you a residual that there's 10 or 15% who are hoaxes, and then there's another 10 or 15% that are honest to God goodness mistakes, and you can keep going like that until you get down to there's a small percentage of cases where none of that plays. And in those cases, these people are sincere. And these may very well be true stories. And if any of these stories are true, they're fascinating. And some of them, by the caliber, and I chose these stories originally because of the caliber of our witnesses. Our witnesses are trained people who do this for a living, who have nothing to gain and everything to lose by coming forward, who reported these things in real time as they were occurring, and who took whatever flack came from it and drew like federal attention. When, if the government truly believed this was all a bunch of hooey, they wouldn't have bothered with Lonnie Zamora or the guys that follow the UFO 86 miles into Pennsylvania. They wouldn't have cared, but they did. So something else is going on. That's my last story for this evening. But if you have any UFO story, if you have stories you would like to hear, you can always reach out to us and let us know. We will try to do some stories in that particular genre. I have to tell you, a lot of my stories are driven by family members and friends who are like, hey, you haven't done a story about blah, blah, blah for a while. But I'd really like you guys as the listeners to reach out to us and let us know. And I would love to be able to tell you some of those tales. Got some great things coming up, but I am always willing to listen.
And to contact us, I mean, you could either comment to any of our videos. We have the email address, paranormalist@theparanormalistpodcast.com. That's down in the description. Whether you're watching this on video, listening on audio, it's in the information for the audio platforms too. So it's there. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a good evening, everybody.
Okay. Good night.
Good night.